This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support for this program. Your number is 877-217-5757. And our email is talk@talklouisiana.org. We start with Dr. Jyotsna Sharma. She is from the country of India, where she grew up and was educated before moving first to Canada, where she got her PhD at the University of Calgary, did some graduate work at Stanford University, and then got into the oil and gas industry and moved from Houston to Bakersfield to Baton Rouge. And for the last 2.5 years, she's been a professor of petroleum engineering at Louisiana State University, one of two females on the faculty in that department, and 15 total. LSU recognized, of course, as you can imagine, is having one of the top petroleum engineering programs in the country. And she is involved in some remarkable research that could mitigate disasters like the Deepwater Horizon. But before we get there, you do have a fascinating backstory, and you do have extensive experience in the industry working for Chevron and Shell, and now you're an academician. Does that background in the industry help you?
Hey, Jim, first of all, thanks so much for having me. And yes, definitely, I think it makes me a better instructor, because petroleum is such an applied field, and having a first-hand experience on how the well works, how all the different equipment and both downhole and surface stuff works, it gives me a better picture that I can then hopefully convey to the students. So it is very helpful.
How is the industry evolving?
I think in many ways, first of all, from the standpoint of the energy transition in general, I think they are, they are looking at the long term, where, you know, it will not just be the oil and gas in the energy portfolio, but there'll be a mix of many different things. So that transition is definitely happening, and it's been happening for some time. But of course, like, you know, for an oil and gas company, it's their expertise. So they're not going to, you know, most of them will still have primarily, you know, their hands in petroleum. But I think they will have other things in their portfolio, like geothermal and others. And I think there is also a transition, and in terms of more women in oil and gas, because in general, it has been one of those industries where, it's not as diverse in that sense. But I think that has changed quite a bit. And I feel very happy when I see many, you know, women who are taking in petroleum in LSU. So that makes me happy. Yeah.
How do you see the world, though, 10 years from now? We're supposedly going to all electrical vehicles in 2035, which is 14 years away. Are they concerned at ExxonMobil and at other places about whether this transition can be made effectively so that people can remain employed and those huge business operations can remain afloat? What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's the big question that is keeping a lot of people in petroleum up some, you know, at night. But I think like maybe 10 years is probably a short time frame. Maybe, you know, more than that down the line, I do see that other energy sectors will play a strong role. However, as we see the energy breakdown right now, oil and gas and hydrocarbons still play a major role in, you know, everything, not just, you know, fueling our cars and planes and all that, but about every industry relies on oil and gas.
In more ways than we know.
Absolutely. Like even like the Vaseline that we put, you know, the lip balm. I mean, even that's a petroleum byproduct. Sometimes we don't realize.
It is called petroleum jelly.
That's right. Yeah. So it's, I do feel though that energy industry, and that's where, you know, a lot of passion for my research, you know, my goal is also to make it safer so that what we are doing, we can make it more efficient, more, you know, environmentally friendly. So that, you know, the people can also see that, yes, we can do this in a manner that is still, conducive to the environmental, changes and so on. But we can still provide energy to the world. And I do think that we can do both of those things and have a balance.
Well, before we get to your research, which is remarkable, I'm getting these emails from Senator Cassidy, who was on the Energy Committee in the Senate, and he's basically saying that our president, Joe Biden, is destroying the industry. Well, the price of oil per barrel is almost $80 now, and there's more drilling going on now than under the Biden administration than there was under the Trump administration. ExxonMobil stock has almost doubled in the last year. It doesn't seem like Joe Biden's destroying the industry, but yet we have Senator Cassidy saying exactly that. You're smiling. Why?
I wouldn't want to get into too much of politics, I think. But I think that the energy industry is doing a good job at doing everything we can in terms of technology to make our operations safer. And a lot of, all these research that we do and all these application of the technologies are in that direction. And I honestly don't, I feel that, there is a truth to, the climate change. And we do have to, we cannot just say that it's not happening. And not just energy industry, every industry has to work together to address that. And in oil and gas, we need to, improve our methods, continue to improve. There is always room for improvement. So I have, no political comments on, President Biden or Bill Cassidy.
You're trying to stay out of trouble. You do have a job with the government.
Right.
877-217-5757 is your number for Dr. Jyotsna Sharma, professor of petroleum engineering at Louisiana State University. And this research, funded by a $750,000 grant from the U.S. Department of Energy, aims to find a different source of light for the fiber optic cable that would reduce noises in and around, such as sounds from the surrounding water, and could mitigate the kinds of disasters we had, as we saw with Deepwater Horizon. Do you think this is going to work?
Definitely. Like we have showed that it can work. We even demonstrated it to some of our industry partners. And the fiber optic sensing, it has been used for some time now, and oil and gas, like we have been picking up the application in oil and gas more recently, but fiber optic sensors are even used for, like the buildings, like structural integrity monitoring in aircrafts, like to make sure that there are no cracks in dams, and even in biosensing where we can, sense things in the body. So the application in oil and gas, like definitely for the leak detection and even for monitoring what kind of fluids are coming in the well, whether the fluids are leaving, leaking somewhere from the well bore, I think that is very critical, because, a small leak can cause, it just adds up the damage because of the leakage.
877-217-5757 for Dr. Jyotsna Sharma, professor of petroleum engineering at LSU, doing some remarkable research on how to mitigate disasters such as the Deepwater Horizon tragedy of 2010. Trish in Grand Coteau. Hi, Trish.
Good morning. Good morning. I don't have a question. I have a greeting. I come from a family of three generations of oil people and Stanford graduates. And she might know my great uncle was Max Steinecke. He brought in the first oil well in Bahrain. And then my dad drilled oil wells for Standard Oil in Taft, California, which is west of Bakersfield. And my brother is currently in the oil business now in California. So I'm thinking I should have listened to my professors who wanted me to stay one more year and finish my degree in geology at Stanford.
Well, you did some work at Stanford, and it's a great school, and some would be surprised that Stanford is a place where a petroleum engineering specialist would be educated.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's pretty cool. And, we always need petroleum engineers and geologists work hand in hand. Like we get, so much information from the geologists. So that's great that you studied there, and very nice to know that you have the long family history of oil and gas.
You are working in conjunction with a crew at the University of Oklahoma. How is that working?
Yeah, it's been working good. Of course, because of the COVID and the travel restrictions, we haven't been able to meet face-to-face, and we had some plans of doing experiments together. That has been delayed. But, in this day and age and the technology, we can still do video conferencing. And in fact, the same fiber optics that has made the high-speed internet possible, it's the same cable that we're using for sensing. So it's in that sense, like it's making many things happen.
Well, last time LSU and Oklahoma played on the football field, the Tigers won 63-28, and so we know LSU is a superior institution. And the team from LSU and OU is trying to test findings in LSU's 5,000-foot deep test well. Some people didn't even know that LSU has a test well.
Yeah, and actually six of them, not just one. And
we're the only university in the country, aren't we?
I believe so. And in fact, when I was interviewing at different universities, like when I was thinking of going back into academia after working for Chevron, like that was when I saw those wells, I was like, wow, this is the place I want to be, because that was really the main driving force. Because having that kind of access to wells and doing experiments, that's just second to none.
Your number is 877-217-5757. We'll talk about other matters of importance with Mark Ballard and with Jim Gates, but we're going to spend a few more moments with Dr. Jyotsna Sharma from LSU. So if you'd like to get in, this is the time. We're back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Dr. Jyotsna Sharma is with us. The last 2.5 years, she has spent quality time at Louisiana State University, a young, vibrant, impressive person who has an unusual collection of experiences. She has actually worked in the oil and gas industry, and she is now at the cutting edge of research on how to stop disasters such as the horrible one that killed, 11 people on April 20th, 2010, the Deepwater Horizon tragedy. 877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. Holly in the Garden District asks, how many people on the faculty at LSU, the 15 petroleum engineering professors, how many have a background in the oil and gas industry?
I think a few of them, I would say maybe 3 or 4 who have worked in the oil and gas industry. Others have, they joined academia after their PhD.
Yeah. Most do not, though. They're academicians. Yeah. And that's not unusual. Doesn't mean they don't know what they're talking about.
Of course, yeah.
But I think it helps to have experience, just like it would help if the head of LABI, for example, had actually run a business. But that's not the case. 877-217-5757 is your number for Dr. Jyotsna Sharma, and she is a vibrant person who has fallen in love with Baton Rouge, and we didn't have a high bar to to surpass. You were living in Bakersfield. That's the Dust Bowl, isn't it?
Yeah, I like that term, but also for someone who works in oil and gas, like we see wells everywhere, and it kind of like, almost it's gratifying because it just shows, how much at least that town relies on, petroleum, and it just makes you feel at home. Like as a petroleum engineer, I'm like, I love it. Some mm-hmm. people don't like that kind of view, but I like it.
Well, this fiber research that you're doing, it is such that I know some people are calling on you for your expertise, especially after the attention you've received of late. But tell us how this fiber works. Does it know where the noise is coming from? Can it pinpoint that?
Right. Yes, yes. And actually, I just brought the fiber also. It's very thin. It's a glass strand, uh-huh. almost the thickness of our hair. Yeah, so it's highly, it's not intrusive at all. It's so, so small. And the light travels through the fiber, and it basically backscatters or bounces back. And when you have any kind of leak or fluid movements, that light, how it comes back, it changes. And we basically analyze that light spectrum and interpret that with, okay, there is a leak happening. And the biggest advantage of fiber optic sensors compared to like the different gauges and the conventional mm-hmm. Probes and sensors is that the entire fiber is a sensor. So if we have a 5,000 feet long cable, the entire 5,000 feet is a sensor. So we are sensing at every spot in the fiber. So that's why we call it distributed sensing. So the whole fiber is a sensor.
So a pipeline leak would trigger a vibration.
Right, exactly.
And alert workers of a potential breach, and they didn't have time to respond in the right. Deepwater Horizon tragedy. And there have been others. Yeah. And you're confident that this will mitigate those kinds of incidents, and it is important for people to be safe.
Yes.
And that's first and foremost. And These people were just out there trying to make a living for themselves and their families, and some gave their lives for doing so. And Jyotsna Sharma is on the cutting edge of trying to make it a safer and better operation, and we commend her for that. Now, there was a fine piece about you 3 days ago in The Advocate. LSU has done a nice job promoting your research, but The Advocate story, I'm told, has generated attention for you nationally. You're getting lots of phone calls, aren't you?
Yeah, and you know, it kind of for a researcher, you know, the ideal thing is when the research can be applied and industries can use it, and we can see that in action. And some, you know, pipeline companies have contacted me. They want to test out the sensor. There are also like storage places, like where they are storing oil in caverns, and they want to see if the fiber optic sensors can be used in that kind of application. So it's been great. And I really hope that we can test it out in some of those areas, because ultimately I don't want to do research just for the sake of doing research, but rather to apply it in the industry and make it safer.
And you say this is relatively inexpensive.
The fiber is very, very inexpensive. It's like few dollars per, you know, per 100 feet of cable. But it's the data that generates, like the fiber generates a lot of data, like because we acquire data at very high frequency, so terabytes of data in an hour. So we have to, so like some of the algorithms I develop using cloud-based computing, we make it more efficient to analyze and interpret that data, so that it's very easy for someone at the rig floor to see that, okay, this is the leak is happening or gas is coming up. We want to really simplify that process so that we don't need an expert to stand there and do the interpretation in real time.
Well, Dr. Sharma says the key advantage we have with fiber optic cable is that the whole fiber is sensory. It increases the visibility of leaks tremendously. Now, is this going to be a necessity, something that is a given in the oil and gas industry?
I really hope that we will go in that direction. Like, of course, my research is we are kind of, you know, smoothing the kinks, so to say. Like, you know, there are some limitations of fiber. Like one of them I mentioned was a lot of data that it generates, and for people it's not very easy to interpret the data. So my research focuses on how we can make simple algorithms, easy ways to do signal processing and analyze the data. And also with the quantum sensing, we want to make it even more sensitive, so we can detect the smallest of leak. Because even with every kind of sensor has a noise floor, so basically it cannot hear like a vibration below a certain, you know, threshold. We call it a noise floor. And with the quantum light, instead of using a normal laser, by using quantum light source, we want to even reduce that noise floor, so it becomes sensitive to even the smallest of leaks. So that, you know, we can, as oil and gas, you know, does drilling and exploration in the North Poles and you know, all these deep water offshore areas, we can make it very safe for any kind of leaks.
Mm-hmm. Your passion is infectious. So, how did you develop this fierce passion for what you do?
I think, you know, like my background, my undergraduate was in electrical engineering, but then I got hired on by Schlumberger, and I had no idea when I was at a, you know, rig floor, and we had to like even sleep in the pickup and do like logging job. But then slowly it was just such a gratifying thing to just see oil coming out of ground and just see, you know, what you're doing live in action. And I just fell in love with petroleum. And so many people ask me, you did electrical engineering, you are now in petroleum. Like, that makes no sense. And to me, like, I just, like, love it. It's very cool.
Well, we look forward to an update. And congrats on the reception you're getting and doing LSU well. Dr. Jyotsna Sharma, Professor of Petroleum Engineering. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Same here.
And we're joined now by Jim Gates, the pride of Benton, Louisiana, who I think we've just lost telephonically, but Jim is a lawyer of note in the great city of Opelousas. And he and I went to college. We were freshmen together at Hodges Hall back in the year of 1977, coming up on 44 years since we entered Hodges, which at that time had no air conditioning, no hot water in the showers. It was somewhat primitive in those days, but we managed to get along and we've known each other for a long time. And he worked his way through college, and he had job after job after job. And he has a remarkable story to tell about how those jobs intersected with the life of the Cajun Prince, Edwin Washington Edwards, who died, as we know, Monday at the age of 93. August 7th, 1927, July 12, 2021, for Edwin Washington Edwards. Services will be this weekend. He will lie in state at the Capitol Rotunda on Saturday, and then Sunday, a private service at the old state capitol for the man who led our state for 16 years, the sixth longest tenure in American history for a governor. And in modern time, few have exceeded the four terms that Edwin Washington Edwards had as governor of Louisiana in a span over three decades, elected first in 1971 and last in 1991. From 44 to 68, he was in the governor's office 16 of those 24 years. We'll talk with Jim if things go according to plan, and also hear from Mark Ballard, Capitol Bureau Chief, after this pause. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number, and we're trying to make a telephonic connection to Jim Gates in Opelousas. We're having some challenges, and if we can't get him in the next few minutes, Matt, let's go to Mark Ballard, who I'm sure is waiting for his Thursday visit. He's always charitable and full of insights about the world at large, and we've had a week that rivals few others with the death of Louisiana's longest-serving governor, Edwin Edwards, and the prospect of a veto session, which is part of the 1974 Constitution, which in large part was constructed by Edwin Edwards. When I say constructed, there was a constitutional convention, but the governor at the time was the Cajun Prince, and he had much to say about what happened. And Jim Gates, I think we have you, so go ahead.
Yeah,
yeah, beautiful. My friend of almost 44 years, who is now a prominent lawyer in Opelousas, and you, like I, we didn't live in fraternity houses. We lived in a primitive dorm in Hodges.
I'm honored to be on your show, Jim, and was listening with interest to Dr. Sharma and thinking a few minutes ago about how far LSU has come since Hodges Hall, an unair-conditioned dorm where we lived together. And as I recall, when we first started school, it rained about 50 to 60 days in a row.
It did. It did.
It did indeed.
In fact, in those days, to show you how primitive it was, LSU didn't even have an indoor football practice facility, so they had to go in the field house to work out, and it didn't work out very well. But that's another story. But Jim went on.
I remember going over there to cool off.
Yeah, yeah, well, yeah. We would go to the Union anywhere they had an air conditioning, because there was none at Hodges Hall, and as I recall, no, at least on the floor I was on, floor two, there was no hot water in the showers either. It was it was an indoctrination into a different kind of life, and sometimes it's good to rough it. But Jim and I remember also were roommates at Kirby Smith, which is about, not roommates, but we were residents at the same time at Kirby Smith many moons ago. But I knew he was headed for great things, and he is one of the most prominent lawyers in the state. But you worked your way through college, and along the way you had job after job, sometimes in different locations, and this story about your background intersects with the life and times of Edwin Edwards. Tell me more.
All right. Well, it was interesting to me, because as I've told these stories over the years, I've seen those stories intersect with other people's similar stories about our late governor. I think the story you're referring to was back in, let's see, it would have been summer and fall of 1981. I was working as a waiter at the Sky Club at Louisiana Downs in Bossier City during that summer. And that was the only legal gambling in the state back then, pari-mutuel wagering on the horses. Governor Edwards was a real fan of that, knowledgeable about it. And very knowledgeable and an entertaining person to wait on if you're lucky enough to have him in your section during the course of the day. And there were several times I waited on him during the summer. It came the fall, started back at LSU, but on Saturdays and Sundays, I would work up in Bossier City because it seems like the oil prices were high. Everybody owned a racehorse, and they would tip very well back then.
Yes.
So I'd worked on a weekend up there and waited on Edwin and his friends, who will remain nameless, some of whom went to trial with him several years later on a couple of occasions, but all day Saturday and Sunday. At the end of the day, I leave, I drive down to Baton Rouge, I'm going late at night, I'm in class the next day, and then I went to work my part-time job in Baton Rouge, waiting tables at the Camelot Club. And so that night, after having spent the weekend taking care of Edwin, I go to work, here he and the same crew come again. I'm handing them their menus, and he looks at me and says, "Jimmy, are you following me around the state?" Jumps up and starts mockingly frisking me to see if I'm wearing a wire.
So,
and I wasn't, of course.
Others
Well, later on, maybe others were, but he was just being entertaining. But I think he got kind of interested in maybe, you know, who I was, started asking me questions about where I was in school and such as that, and asked the real precise questions, mm-hmm. like, did you take 71 or Highway 1 down last night? And I said, Highway 1, back to your old hometown of Marksville. And this was well before I-49 was built. And I was always impressed because when he came to those situations, I waited on him on several different restaurants at different times over those years during that period of time. He always tipped really well, and he would always go back in the kitchen and check in with the invisible people in the restaurant, the cooks and the people washing dishes, and check in on them and see how they were doing because he was really interested. Fast forward a few years, 1984. It was summer of 84, the World's Fair. He was governor again. I was working for Senator Sidney Nelson from Shreveport. I'm standing there, and Edwin is coming down into the legislature to try to get the World's Fair bailout package passed. And he sees me standing there, and I'm just another knucklehead kid, you know, trying to go to school. And he says, "Hey, Jimmy, are you still waiting tables?" I said, "No, I'm in law school working for Senator Nelson." And he just kind of gives me a thumbs up and breezes right on by. And I kind of stood there in shock that he would remember who I was. He goes on about his business, rescues the World's Fair. Fast forward again, 1991, he's running for governor against David Duke. I'm out at the Yambley Festival, been practicing law by that point since 85. We're at a fundraiser. He comes, speaks at the Yambley. The place is packed, everyone on their feet cheering for him, everyone in a receiving line trying to shake his hand. I'm standing there. He sees me, kind of waves at me and says, "Jimmy, are you still waiting tables?" I said, "No, I've been practicing law for about 6 years." And he says, "Well, you got a raise from 15% to a third." And I was kind of rendered speechless.
Well, he knew who you were. You're a memorable guy, but so was he. And his skills politically were unparalleled, and that's why he was elected over and over. And he when he met somebody and he got to know you, and in your case, he got to know you, he knew you for life. But Jim.
And it was the entertaining thing about it is that I noticed about him, and gosh knows we've met a lot of politicians in the last 44 years, Jim, is that he noticed people that were working around them. He remembered people that were taking care of him because he cared about their lives. And that was one of the great and special things about our late governor that I will always, always remember and treasure, having been in his orbit for just a few times.
Well, it's good to catch up with you, if only briefly, and let's keep it going. The pride of Benton, Louisiana, Jim Gates, who has now spent most of your life, I guess, in Opelousas. You like that
That's
town
right.
a whole lot.
The governor, I started off up north, and I moved south, just like he did.
Well, thank you, Jim. Great to hear your voice.
Thank you so much.
Keep up your great work in the courtroom. And with us now is Mark Ballard, Capitol Bureau Chief for The Advocate. And Mark, before we get to the veto override session, this week has been the week to talk about the former governor, Edwin Edwards, and you, like others, rub shoulders with him a time or two.
Yes, and Jim was right about that, is that he remembers everybody and remembers and remembered, you know, into the past. I mean, it wasn't just a name trick in his mind, but he seemed to be able to associate all of what you have been doing and what you've been going through, and bring it back immediately. So he had a gift for that.
And a complex legacy, as The Advocate and the Picayune did in its edition on the day after he died on Tuesday, the 13th, the headline, Edwin W. Edwards, controversial but popular four-term governor, dies at 93. And then the quote beneath it, "I play by the rules, but I take all the advantages the rules allow." He didn't shy away from a guy who was right to the edge, and some say went over the edge.
Well, obviously there was a federal jury in Baton Rouge that felt that he went over the edge, but no, he never shied away from it, and he never tried to apologize for it. And I think that was something that was remarkable from what we see in politicians these days. And he also didn't seem to have a partisan orientation. I mean, I do agree that he aimed primarily at helping regular people in Louisiana, and sometimes that went over the edge.
877-217-5757. We're going to play a few cuts from Edwin Edwards over the course of the next few days, and for those who remember his conviction in 2000, well, there was an acquittal in 1986 in a federal trial that was a retrial after the jury voted 11-1 to acquit. John Voltz went for it again. Washington Edwards was acquitted, and here's how he reacted in the year of 1986.
John Voltz started this thing over a year ago with 8 defendants, members of my family and my friends, with a political mission trying to get 8 innocent people convicted of a false charge. He had 355 counts. He didn't convict anyone and didn't win on any one of the 355 counts.
That's Edwin Edwards, 1986. Is there another cut accompanying that one, Matt?
Freedom. You don't know what it means till somebody with power tries to take it away from you. And I want to stand here for just a few moments and bask in the fact that I am in America, that I am free.
And that is Edwin Edwards, and we will hear more when we return after this. This is Jim Engster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. Mark Ballard with us. And if you'd like to talk with the Capitol Bureau Chief for The Advocate, 877-217-5757, Patrick in Innisfil Estates. Hi, Patrick. You're on with Mark.
Hey, of course, I'm not the biggest fan of Edwin Edwards. I'm a Republican. I do know my mother. I couldn't vote in that election when he ran against David Duke, but I know my mother voted for him over David Duke, of course. And many Republicans did. But that being said, even though he's unpopular with, you know, some of the things he did unpopular with Republicans, I do think he should be buried at the state capitol. I mean, he's part of Louisiana history. He's one of the longest serving governors we've ever had. And he's like a Huey P. Long type character. I mean, why not let him be buried at the state capitol? It's history.
All right. Patrick, an adversary of Edwin Edwards, says he should be buried at the Capitol. I don't think that's going to happen, but I, like Patrick, believe it would be highly appropriate for the longest-serving governor to be there, and he ruled that Capitol for longer than anybody else, Mark.
Well, and there's been a lot of talk about that, adding him, because Huey Long's at the state Capitol, and there has been a lot of talk about that. I don't think that's happening. The family is going to inter him in the Rest Haven, I think, in South Baton Rouge, and in the cemetery there.
Well, he will be at Rest Haven. He did say to me on this show that he wanted to be at the Capitol, but if he couldn't, he would prefer to be at the military cemetery. He was a veteran. That's something we haven't talked a lot about, but he went in right out of high school and at the end of World War II. So technically, even though he acknowledges he didn't see any battle, he is a World War II veteran, Mark.
Yeah, a fighter pilot, and he, you know, he could easily be in the military veterans cemetery as well.
Well, he lost one race before the ill-fated run for Congress, which was obviously a joke. He was trying to win in a gerrymandered district against a Republican, and it didn't work. And it was Garrett Graves' first win and Edwin Edwards' last loss, and some would say his only loss, because he withdrew in 1987 after finishing second in the primary to Charles Buddy Romer in October of 1987, 34 years ago. At the Monteleone in the early morning hours, Edwin Edwards came out before his loyal following, and here's how he sounded on that night.
Circumstances, since I did not run first, that it would be inappropriate for me to continue this election. Please hear me out. Please hear me out. I have to do what I think is best for my state. I don't want it further divided. There's never been a time in modern history when the combined efforts of the media has been so bent and dedicated on taking over the governor's office.
And it was not only best for the state, it was best for Edwin Edwards, Mark Ballard.
It is. I mean, the standard thought is that if an incumbent doesn't win in the, or at least doesn't run first and doesn't get close to 50% in the primary election, that he's likely to lose in the runoff. So there's that. And but it certainly did help out his political future in that he basically took away from Romer the chance to have a mandate when he went in as governor. And so he spent the entire time, Romer spent the entire time putting out fires for the most part. And that is sometimes, and it certainly was in his case, an unpopular task to do. And so when 4 years later came about, he was Edwards was in prime position to run again. What and do you win, as we saw he did.
What do you recall most about him, Mark?
Well, I recall most about him the personal things. I mean, there's obviously watched an awful lot of the trials and the controversy that went around him. But on a personal level, your previous guest had mentioned, was that he was able to approach you on a personal level on what's important to you personally. He came to visit Donna when she was with ALS, and she remembers that one of the best visits that she had. When he left, you know, she felt upbeat and honored that he would come to her house and visit her while she was in the hospital bed.
Well, he had great qualities, and as we know, he had some roguish qualities, and he did not ever try to say he didn't. He was what you saw was what you got. And in 2000, he was convicted, May 9th, 2000. Ironically, 28 years to the date that he took office as governor the first time. And here he was on the courthouse steps in 2000 accepting his fate.
The Chinese have a saying that if you sit by the river long enough, the dead body of your enemy will come floating down the river. I suppose the feds sat by the river long enough, so here comes my body. I regret that it has ended this way, but that is the system. I live 72 years of my life within the system. I'll spend the rest of my life within the system.
And he did. He went to jail for 10 years, and he served 8.5, 99 months to be exact. And he took it about as well as any human can take going to prison. And here's a man who could live life and did live life in the grandest style imaginable and humiliated in a way that few others have been in public life. And yet he came back and back and back. He was one of a kind, Mark.
And one of the things, excuse me, that he said over and over again after getting out of prison was that you don't hold a grudge. If you want to live a long life, don't hold a grudge. Just move on. And one thing that struck me was, and I had seen him in a lot of venues after he got out of prison and really into his 90s, and he was always extremely sharp. And in that election that you mentioned against Garrett Graves, I mean, he was by far the best candidate on the platform.
Oh, he knew the issues, and he had been in Congress, of course. People forget he served three terms as a congressman in addition to four terms as governor. Now, we have this prospect of a veto session that looks like it will happen, so Mark will be putting his reporting boots back on Tuesday at the Capitol. What do you anticipate?
Well, I think you're right. I think that we are going to have an historic veto override session. They only need a majority in the House and a majority in the Senate to hold one. We'll find out, well, tomorrow morning, the votes will come in tonight at midnight, and they'll count them in the morning. And so we should know by this time tomorrow whether or not we're going to have a veto session. I suspect we will. But at that point, it becomes a lot of politics involved. The main thing that's driving the veto session is the transgender bill, and there is a lot of push, particularly among the evangelical churches, to override the veto. And then there's an equal push among many members of the business community to sustain the veto. So, and it'll be a very close vote. The fact that it got 2/3 in the legislature, I don't think means the same thing when you're talking about overriding a veto. If we see one of these bills get overridden, I think we're going to see all 28 come up.
Well,
that's my guesstimate.
You have been following the machinations away from the scene right now, and there are those, as you can imagine. And one of them involves Ronnie Johns, a veteran lawmaker. What's going on with Ronnie Johns?
Well, he had needed a knee replacement surgery, and it had been postponed for, 2 years now. And so on July 7th, he went in and got that knee replacement surgery. And his doctor says, look, you need to stay off of it for at least 4 weeks. And he talked with his, before going in to get the surgery, he went and talked with colleagues in the Senate and asked their opinion on it. They all said, of course. And so he's not going to be there. And that essentially means a no vote for Edwin Edwards because John Bell Edwards. Sorry,
right.
There's too many Edwards, as he says. And that essentially means a no vote because to override, he has to have 26 votes in the state Senate. And in the House, they're going to need 70 votes.
So, yeah, John.
And they have to achieve that number. And it just makes it more difficult without Ronnie Johns there.
Okay. We've got about 45 seconds, but two listeners have asked me not to get away this week without asking you the front page story Saturday of The Advocate. Landry's agents assist mega donor. Investigators help Guidry in adoption dispute. What in the world's going on here?
Well, you pretty much summed it up in the headline. He is helping the guy that has given him more money than anybody else and is very close to the attorney general. And many people have raised questions as to whether he should have gotten involved in this kind of a dispute.
That's Shane Guidry, by the way, of fame, because he's the son of Robert Guidry, who was the key witness against Edwin Edwards. Louisiana is a circular world when it comes to our people. Mark, we're glad you're in our orbit. We'll call on you again next Thursday. One of the best in the business, and he calls Baton Rouge home. Mark Ballard, First Financial Tax and Accounting Services, provides signature support tomorrow. The leadoff guest is Murphy Paul, the Chief of Police. Stay safe and stay tuned.